Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival. My guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. You can find him on the internet. He publishes and broadcasts from Japan, where he's been for the past 10, 11 years. How long have you been there now, James?
This is a year number 11.
The 11th year. Well, is that a lucky number? Is that a lucky number in Japan?
Not that I know of, no.
Lucky numbers here in the United States, mm-hmm. or at least if you're crapshooter, but
well, you know, in the United States they often don't have a 13th floor in apartment buildings. Here they often don't have a fourth floor.
It's because, an engineering marvel, isn't it?
Yeah. 12 to 14, who knows?
Those buildings with a missing floor, the one, do they just float up there above the third, where the 13th
floor? In Japan, the unlucky number is 4 because it's the same word as death. So there's often not a fourth floor in the apartment buildings here.
Tell you a story. This is a true story. This happened to me back, this had to be in the 70s, probably back around 1970 or something like that. I was sitting in a bar in Waupaca, Wisconsin, came in after work. I was working construction at the time, came in after work, sat down at the bar, and there's a guy sitting there at the bar, and he's got shot glasses in front of him, and he's just choking these shot glasses down. His watch is sitting on the bar, and he looks at me, and I don't even know this guy. He looks at me and he says, "You want to buy a watch?" "I want to buy a watch." He said, "Yeah, I'll sell you this watch." And at the time, you know, it was a decent watch. It probably cost $100, which was, you know, wasn't big money, but it was something back in 1970. Mm-hmm. And he shows me the watch, and it's got a day-date thing on it, the rest of that sort of thing, and second-hand, all that. And he, "Why, how much?" I'll sell it to you for $20. And I looked at it, and the problem was, it had one of those little windows on the watch. It was a mechanical watch. And they had one of the windows where the day changed, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you know, M-O-N-T-U-E, right. W-E-D, and so on. All right. And it would, there was a wheel under there, and I've seen them before, where the wheel rotates at midnight and you have a new day. And
right.
And it gives, tells you, all right. He got up that morning and the wheel had skipped to the word die.
Oh.
D-I-E. All right?
Wow.
He got up in the morning and his watch says die. And he's trying to sell that watch in the bar to anybody who'll take it. And I'm sitting there watching, and there's other people. I didn't want it, and nobody else wanted it either. He was practically giving it away. What apparently happened, what I think happened, is they had a disc inside that had the day abbreviation in a number of different languages.
Right,
they probably had French and English and German. And I'm guessing the D-I-E was perhaps in German. I don't know. But it skipped a notch. But it was just funny. You talk about number 4 rhymes with
death. Right. And, yeah. Well, and people are funny that way sometimes. Did you buy it?
No. And neither would anyone else. He couldn't get rid of it. But it was, you know, he didn't die as near as I know. So,
well, Alfred, I'm feeling I'm feeling a little bit intellectually adventurous today, so I have a proposal for you, and feel free to say no. But I think it might be interesting for the audience out there. We've been talking for at least a year by now, and maybe longer than that. And I haven't really had an opportunity to get to know you, and I am much more comfortable being on the other side of the mic interviewing people than I am being interviewed. Perhaps you would allow me to interview you today instead of the other way around and ask a little bit about your background.
That's not what I expected, that's for sure. But yeah, I'll give it a go.
Excellent. Well, this is good because, again, I do know a little bit of your work and I've seen you before on some other programs, but I don't know the big background story of Alfred Adisk and how he got involved in all of this, because I'm assuming that you weren't born the constitutionalist and the sort of sovereign rights kind of defender that you are at this point. How did your political transition, awakening, understanding unfold?
It's a story that goes all the way back to Adam and Eve.
We have time.
It's one of those things where Eve, in my petition, she took a bite out of the apple. And next thing you know, I was caught in a divorce. Hmm. And lost custody of my kids for no particular reason other than that's just the way they do business down here in Texas. This goes back to 1983. I actually had a roofing business at the time. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And we were doing okay. But she filed for divorce and everything blew up and everything just turned to excrement before it was done. And that's what opened my eyes. Up until then, I had been fat, dumb, and happy. Like most people, you go through life, and if you are not personally subject to injustice, you don't see it. Mm. It's not apparent to you. But in my case, the courts came along and essentially hit me right between the eyes with a 2x4. And where I had previously been able to, I saw the world in just shades of gray. Huh? All of a sudden, after I got hit by that 2x4, I could see the bright red color of injustice for the first time in my life. I thought I would study the law. I don't mean by going to law school, but I was an intelligent man. Young man, I mean, and not high IQ and so on. And I thought, it'll take me somewhere between 18 months and maybe 3 years. And I'll figure out by reading the law and studying the law, I'll figure out how to rectify this problem. Well, I started reading the law, and a year and a half went by, and nothing, I wasn't able to accomplish anything. And 3 years went by, 7 years went by, and I accomplished nothing. But I got to a point where I really was fascinated by the law. What had started up, all I wanted, I was going to use the law to build a better broadsword. And I was going to use it. I would extract vengeance on my ex-wife and on her attorney. I was going to go back with the law and I was going to slice them up into chunks. But I never got any vengeance and I never did rectify the situation. But I got into this and started a new newsletter for a legal reform group I was associated with here in Dallas. One thing led to another, and it became a magazine called The Anti-Shyster. I published a magazine for 12 years. I was a big fish in a small pond there for a while, and been the Washington Times and New York Times and newspapers around the country, even around the world, interviewed by French radio, Norwegian TV. Been on 60 Minutes. I don't know if you saw that.
I did. I saw. It's not necessarily something you'd be happy about, but the way they portrayed you.
Delighted. I was pretty well pleased. Believe me, it could have been worse.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. The problem, I was interviewed one time by a woman, came over to the house. She wanted me to speak on gun control issues. And she came over. She was from one of the local news programs in Dallas, and she was good looking. This is 10, 15 years after the divorce, 1995 or something like that. In the 90s, someplace in the 90s. She came over and she wanted me to make a few comments on gun control laws, and she brought the cameraman and whatever, and I thought they're coming over for 3 minutes. They wanted me to make a couple comments for 3-4 minutes, and fine, I'd do that, and they'd be on their way. Well, I sit down, and she starts talking to me and posing questions, and I start going ahead and answering, and this is going on, and she's just, oh, my gosh. I mean, she agreed with everything I had to say and found it all just fascinating and amazing and the rest of this sort of thing. And I'm thinking, she's coming to our Citizens for Legal Reform meeting.
I think I know where this is going.
I mean, I think I'm in love. I think I've got myself. Uh-huh. That night, they interviewed me on the camera for an hour. And that night, they ran an excerpt. They cherry-picked what I had to say. And they made me, they put it together in a way where I was saying things that if I hadn't seen it myself, I would have bet any amount of money that there's no way in the world I could have said this. Hmm. Right? They can take the statements out of context. I don't mind doing live interviews, but when you let people record, they can cherry pick the stuff out and make you look like a complete idiot. And my point is, 60 Minutes really could have done more of a hatchet job on me than they did. Hmm. And one of the things that happened is that what I found out later on is there were people who were following the 60 Minutes website, and they have something, I think it's called After Hours, and where people comment on whatever programs were on that day or last week or whenever, and they weigh in and they say yes, no, thumbs up, thumbs down, the rest of it. Well, people who followed this told me later on that the comments were running 2-1 in my favor. Most of the people who heard that said, yeah, I think this guy's right. And that delighted me because there's a certain amount of risk involved to standing up and speaking out about sovereignty issues, for example. There's at least, it's not a matter of being paranoid, but it is a matter of recognizing that the government doesn't like that at all. I mean, they don't dislike it a little. They dislike it a lot because it really does go to the heart of the problem the American people have with their government. And they don't like people talking about sovereignty. But I was able to demonstrate that half or two-thirds of the people listening said, yeah, I think he's right. Well, I think that's the kind of news that if the government were interested in prosecuting me for one thing or another, I think that would weigh on their decision to prosecute or not. There's a good chance that I can reach two out of three people sitting on the jury, and they're going to sit back and say, you know, I think maybe that guy's right. So, I don't know. It's one of those things. In any case, I was a kind of a big fish in a small pond there in the 1990s, and since then I've been, you know, I'm still at it.
Well, I understand you ran for the Texas Supreme Court in 1992.
Oh, yeah.
How did that go?
Yeah. Well, I received 201,000 votes for place one of the Supreme Court of the state of Texas. I came in third behind the Republican challenger, Craig Enoch. He had about 4 million votes. Mm-hmm. And the Democrat incumbent, Oscar Mazzi, he had, I don't know, 2 million votes. And I came in with 201,000. All right, so it wasn't a close race. But I was probably the first non-attorney to get on the ballot since the Civil War. According to the Texas Constitution, you've got to be an attorney, licensed attorney, point one, and you have to have been a judge for 10 years at a lower court before you can run for the Supreme Court of Texas. And I'm neither. But I found an 1870 federal law that essentially established all of the rights of the people of Texas at a minimum level as they existed in 1870. They said, Texas can't reduce any of our rights. Well, back then you didn't have to be a licensed attorney to run for the Supreme Court because there weren't any. And my argument was, hey, I got the same rights now as we had in 1870. And much to my surprise, I never thought they'd let me on the ballot. I mean, I tried this as an experiment. I read the law and I said, you know what, I think this means that I could run for the Supreme Court. And I thought, that's crazy. That can't be. But turns out it happened. So
that is absolutely incredible. Well, hats off to you for discovering that little loophole.
Did you ever, I can see you've been doing some of the research. Did you stumble across the lawsuit I got tangled up with in 2006, where I was sued by the Attorney General of the state of Texas.
Haven't heard that, no.
$25,000 per day. That's $9 million per year. That was a good
one. For what, exactly?
That was a good one. Pardon me?
For what?
The alleged crime was the manufacture and distribution of a controlled substance.
Mm-hmm.
The controlled substance was colloidal silver, and I had virtually nothing to do with manufacturing or distributing it, but I was fiduciary for a trust that leased some tables and chairs and a couple of computers to the corporation that was manufacturing this colloidal silver. And because I was fiduciary for the trust, they already had six defendants in the case, a husband and wife in their corporation. That case started in 2001. And then another man, he bought some of their equipment later on, and they added him as a defendant and his corporation and his trust. And he'd asked if I could help, and I said, yeah, I'll see what I can do. And I volunteered to be fiduciary for the trust so I'd have an opportunity to speak in court. All right.
Wow.
And little did I know, I did not understand that if I was the fiduciary for the trust, I would be made a defendant. Each of the defendants were threatened with fines of $25,000 per day, $9 million a year. I stood to lose $2 million. I stood to lose something like $18 million off that deal, and I certainly didn't have it. There's no way I could ever pay it. I read the relevant law. Right? And this is a case that the Attorney General of Texas, they had invested 6 years. I was the last defendant. The case started in 2001. I was added in 2006. All right. I was the last of the seven defendants on there. But I read the relevant law, and it said the key to this case is deciding what the definition of drugs is as a matter of law. And does it conform to the federal definition and also to the definition in the state Texas definition? And I read the relevant law, and I saw the law. I started reading the law. I said, if this is the key to the case, and if I can stop this, we walk out of here. If I can't, I'm in big trouble. Read the relevant law, and it includes the phrase man or other animals. It didn't say man or animals.
Mm-hmm.
It said man or other animals, which means they think man is an animal.
Right.
Okay? And I said, oh, no, I'm not. You have seen, you catch on that I am a bit of a student of the Bible in one thing or another.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that according to the Bible, on the sixth day, God created man in his image and gave him dominion over the animals. And therefore, as a Christian, you can't call me an animal without violating my freedom of religion. And that was the foundation of the defense of religious freedom defense that I crafted. And the net result was that the attorney general dropped the case. They just stopped coming after investing nearly $500,000 in 6 years. They just stopped coming. And they never said why, but I believe it was the freedom of religion defense, because the definition of drugs that we were complaining about, where they define the people to be animals, it lays the foundation for the war on drugs, for the prison industrial complex, for all of the billions of dollars of profits that are made each year by the pharmaceutical industry, and American medicine, which is all about either drugs or medical devices, which are also defined in terms of man or other animals. Everything was on the line here if this case went badly for the government, and they couldn't take the chance, so they dropped. Or at least that's my
well, they don't want to set the bad precedent.
Was,
right.
They never said.
Right. They don't want to set a precedent that goes against what they want to argue.
Oh,
so
absolutely. Yeah. We'll talk more about that in a minute when we get back. We're going to take a break, James, for a couple of commercials. I'm Alfred Ask. I guess I should say James Corbett is not my guest today.
I'm your interviewer.
Here we are on the Corbett Reporter, financial survival or something, but we're both here and we'll try to make this interesting. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back. James, he's kind of turned the tables on me today. Usually I ask the questions when James is our guest, and today James is asking the questions, so let's see what else you got, James. I'll bet you got a couple of questions there that should be.
Well, I do, and I think that previous example of being prosecuted for your placement as a fiduciary of the trust that was providing chairs to the company is one example of this, but I'm assuming that you've had a fair degree of interest from government and other groups, maybe the Southern Poverty Law Center and others that like to try to label people.
Oh, yeah, they. I don't know if they're carrying my name right now. They have in the past. I've threatened to sue them for slander. They took the name off their website, but they may have put it back up. I don't know. But I'm the kind of person that I'm sure that they don't like. They have been complaining about the sovereign citizens movement, which is a bunch of crap. There is no sovereign citizens movement. And according to Southern Poverty Law Center, there are 300,000 members of this movement. Now, I've been around this for a long time, and I'd have a hard time finding half a dozen people that would know that could spell the word sovereign. You understand? And there is no movement. But they say there's 300,000, and they complain that sovereign citizens have been involved in shooting police officers, and they're dangerous and they're violent, right? But if you look at the relevant numbers, you find out that the murder rate in this country is something like 14, if I recall correctly, per 100,000. There's 14 homicides per 100,000 in this country, if I recall correctly. I haven't looked at this for a while. But if you look at the number that the FBI website, they were able to point to something like 6 homicides that were associated with people who identified themselves as sovereigns who were identified out of a period of something like 10 years. If there's 300,000 of us and the average rate is 14 per 100,000, we should find something like 40 deaths per year if sovereigns are just as dangerous as the average man or woman, average guy in the audience right now. If sovereigns were as dangerous as the average man or woman listening to this program, they would be responsible. We should be able to see 40 homicides per year that are associated with sovereigns. They could find six over a course of 10 years. And the implication is the average sovereign is less dangerous than most Amish. You understand? But Southern Poverty Law Center, ooh, a boogeyman. You know, there's a boogeyman. There's a whole bunch of it doesn't stand up.
And I would invite any listeners out there to take a look in my archives. I had a podcast about the Southern Poverty Law Center and the shenanigans that they play for profit. I mean, they make a huge amount of money through their donation base. And they have, I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but more money than you would expect a nonprofit organization like that to have in its coffers. But having said that, well, I don't know about 300,000, but between your audience and mine, we have tens of thousands of listeners' ears at the moment. Why don't we introduce sovereign citizen and what a sovereign citizen is for people out there who don't know what that means?
This is the foundation for American exceptionalism. And I've been working on a book on this subject, and I haven't completed it. It's like a lot of things. You get started on them, and you don't get, I can't seem to get them finished. Prior to the American Revolution, the concept of sovereignty, you could see it in Europe. And it had been pretty much established by the Holy Roman Empire. And the reason a man was king or a woman was queen in a particular country is that they went through a coronation ceremony. The coronation ceremony, the word coronation corresponds to corona. It's also a word for crown. The coronation ceremony took place in a church. They became sovereign because they were the only man or woman in the country who received their rights directly from God. They had the divine right of kings. And everyone else was a subject because they didn't have rights directly from God. Like only the king, and he was sovereign because he received his rights from God. Our Declaration of Independence came along, and very few people understand this, and it is so important. I said in the second sentence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. When this country started out, it said, all men get their rights from God, not just kings. We are all equally endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. This was unprecedented in Western history, right? It's never been done before where they said everybody's a sovereign. And this is borne out in the case of Chisholm versus Georgia, Supreme Court, year of our Lord, 1793, where they said the people of the United States are sovereigns, plural, without subjects. You're a sovereign, I'm a sovereign, Frank, the producer of the program, is a sovereign. That's what was intended. The third sentence of the Declaration says that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. They tell us, that's part of the sentence, there's more, deriving their just powers from the consent of the government. But what they're telling us in the first half of that third sentence, they're saying the purpose of government as envisioned by the founding fathers was to secure to every man, woman, and even unborn child their God-given, unalienable rights. That was the purpose of government. This was the foundation for American exceptionalism. This is why. In my opinion, we had a lot of advantages. There was plenty of resources, a lot of open space. But this is what made this country the land of the free. All right? This is where we had real liberty because we were deemed to each to be sovereigns. And the government had to treat us. If I'm a sovereign, the government is my servant. You know, in a hierarchy, we typically get God number one, people number two, government number three. Sovereigns have to follow God's law. And they have to follow a law that's been enacted by themselves and other sovereigns. But the government being third on this ladder, they are the people's servants. This is where we get our public servants from, the idea that we are sovereign. And the government doesn't want to be the servant. They want to be the master. And what that means is they have weeded us away. They have deceived us and helped us to forget that we were intended to be individual sovereigns. And it's part of the reason why the government is so upset that, oh, these sovereigns, they're crazy. They'll shoot everybody, they'll kill everybody, and they'll eat your children. Well, they won't. What most of the people are that are really serious about sovereignty, they're people who have half a dozen or 10 dictionaries. Right? They're people that read and write, and they study American history, and they try to put pieces together. They're not out to hurt anybody. They're out to do what was intended, and we can find it in our Declaration of Independence, which is still part of the organic law of the United States of America. Well, the point is a lot of people, insofar as you hear about sovereignty, you think it's a political concept, and it has political implications, but the whole force of sovereignty flows from God. And if you don't have that, then you become an animal. And it's consistent with these definitions of drugs and medical devices and food. And in fact, you can look at the 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act. This is where this, so far as I've been able to find out, this was the earliest instance where the government declared implicitly that the people are nothing but animals. In 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act, Section 6, if I recall correctly, it defines food and drugs. It doesn't define medical devices. That came in later on. But food and drugs are both defined in terms of man or other animals, meaning they deem the people to be animals, not men and women made in God's image. And what's interesting about this, 1935, Nuremberg laws in Germany. They passed laws that declared the Jews to be Untermenschen. Unter meaning under and Mensch meaning man, subhuman. They declared them to be animals. Once you are reduced to the status of animals, you can be executed. There's nothing wrong with concentration camps. There's nothing wrong with genocide. It all works just fine so long as you're an animal. This is a big story, and it's one that I have been singularly unsuccessful at explaining and promoting and making people understand the significance. But this is our acts of genocide. You can go to an outfit called genocidewatch.org. Might be .net, but I think it's .org. But Genocide Watch. They've got a document up there that's called the 8 Stages of Genocide. And the third stage, they call it dehumanization. And they specifically say that if you call another group, if you call them insects, vermin, or animals, it's one of the 8 stages of genocide. The way the American law reads on genocide is only government can charge it. Right? And as it turns out, government's the only one who's committing it. And they're the only ones who can charge it legally. But it's not necessary that you kill someone to commit an act of genocide. All you have to do to commit genocide is create circumstances where people are more likely to die than in the circumstances that had previously existed. Insofar as our government has defined us all as, in terms of man or other animals, and it's been going on since 1906, and for whatever it's worth, in 2006, when I figured this out, read it, and then they subsequently dismissed the case, to the best of my knowledge, I'm the first layman to read the law and understand what it means in a century. If anybody else has figured it out and done it, there was no record of it. Right? Nobody's got any court cases they can point to. I think I'm the first guy to read it and understand it since they started it in 1906. But its foundation, again, war on drugs based on the presumption you're animals. All the people that are in prison today, 70% of federal prisoners are allegedly there on drug-related crimes. Every one of those crimes presume those people to be animals, all right? Not sovereigns, animals. And that's, I mean, it's the foundation for a police state. And it's not just here in the United States. I've had people talked about this on radio programs, you know, and some people here in Canada, and some people here in England, and some people here down in Australia. And I've had contact from one person in England and another one from either Australia or New Zealand. They looked at their own definitions of drugs in their countries. And according to them, I never verified this myself, but according to them, the English definition of drugs presumes the people to be animals. in either the Australian or New Zealand, whichever one I report, they reported from, I don't recall. That also presumes the people to be animals, which implies that this is probably a cornerstone for the New World Order. We've heard people talk, you know, that you're just livestock on the global plantation. I've heard them say that for years. I thought it was a metaphor. No, really, that's how they see you. As livestock.
Cattle being fed for the slaughter, absolutely.
Yeah. That's it. Mm-hmm. Not for the profit in the meantime, as long as you can get milk, they can you produce enough wool where they can make a buck off you, they'll keep
it. But once they can't milk you anymore, or it's not productive to, watch out.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I understand. That's what happens. All of a sudden, we're going to have something like mad cow disease, Soylent Green, and so on. But we live in a world, and I'm sure you understand this, that is much different from anything we're led to believe. It's a strange and, it's, you know, potentially dangerous. It's fascinating. It's, what can I say?
It is fascinating. There's no doubt about that. And I think that you and I, we agree on so much of all of that. But I think maybe my difference is interpretive, because I look at the word games that they play through the laws and things like that. And I see that as a game that you can't play without losing. So rather than concentrating on scrying the law for, you know, this or that clause that allows me to claim this or that, I think that ultimately, their laws that they create have no authority over me as a free human being. I'm not a sovereign citizen, per se. I'm a free human being who adheres to natural law, which obviously has nothing to do with parliaments and diets and Congress. But you raise an interesting point that this has to do something fundamentally with American exceptionalism, because myself, as a loyal subject of the Queen and the Dominion of Canada, I don't have those types of rights because there is a sovereign above me, supposedly.
No other nation has ever declared all the people to be in to receive their rights from God and therefore be sovereigns. And that's the implication. It doesn't say that expressly in the Declaration of Independence, but it does say we all get an equal dose of rights from our Creator.
It's an important concept. And
for the American individual.
What are some resources you would recommend people to start looking into the subject? Because as you say, it's so overwhelming. Are there any ways that people can start becoming acquainted with this?
Well, you can visit my blog, which is at adask.wordpress.com. You can start there, but it's one of those things where everybody has their own path. And I don't know that there is a single path that anyone that we can follow. You start looking, and if you're really looking, you'll find what you're looking for, but it takes time. You know, I've been at this now for since 1983, 32 years, trying to make sense of the law. And eventually it does make a kind of sense. You begin to understand what's going on. But we have to break loose. James, we are out of time. I want to thank you for inviting me to be your guest on Financial Survival. I look forward to talking to you again next program will be broadcast again next Thursday. In the meantime, I've been dealing with James Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, from thecorbettreport.com. Thank you, James. Look forward to talking to you in a week.
Thank you for being a good sport. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You can see that I live with these moments. And thank all of you for listening. And hope you'll tune in again tomorrow. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Frank, the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills.